Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Kent Babb, whose new book is Across the River, Life, Death, and Football in an American City. We'll also hear from Samantha Downing, whose third novel is For Your Own Good. Kent Babb is an award-winning sports journalist for The Washington Post and the author of the book, Not a Game, The Incredible Rise and Unthinkable Fall of Allen Iverson, as well as work that has twice appeared in Best American Sports Writing. In his new book, Across the River, Life, Death, and Football in an American City, he tells a great New Orleans story following the Edna Carr Cougars through the 2019 football season. It is unforgettable. Kent Babb, welcome to The Reading Life.
Susan, thank you so much for having me.
Now, you were a bit far afield in Algiers, Louisiana, so tell us how you came upon this story.
In 2018, I got assigned a story by the Washington Post, my employer, to sort of look at this coach that I'd never heard of named Bryce Brown, who seemed to be very honest about some of the problems that had befallen New Orleans in terms of gun violence. In 2016, I had come down to write about the killing of Will Smith. And I left just thinking, you know, there's just more to this story. You know, I learned so much about the city and its problems politically and economically and how it was dealing with what was clearly a gun violence epidemic. And I remember a politician called me and had an off-the-record conversation with me about how, you know, this is really not a problem here. Gun violence, murder is really not a New Orleans thing. And it just never made sense to me that that was the message. That it wasn't that we have to attack this, we have to stop this, we have to save lives. It was, please don't tell a national or Washington, D.C. audience that New Orleans has a gun problem. It wasn't congruent in my head. And so by 2018, an editor of mine sent me a story about Bryce Brown, who was the complete opposite. He was very honest about this. He was just sort of tired of the political games, the denial. He said, look, you know, we have a problem here. Mm-hmm. And this was the day after two young people got killed right outside an Edna Carr basketball game on what was supposed to be National Signing Day for the football team. This was supposed to be a great day for Edna Carr. Instead, it wound up being just another, you know, day filled with blood and denial. And I think that was Bryce's sort of last straw where he said no more. And I went down, wrote a story, and it turned into a book, and it changed my life.
Mm-hmm. Now, he is so interesting. He starts from this basic stance of priding himself on being a car man and wanting his players to be car men, too. And everything he does is toward building that identity. And yet, this is a team that's really haunted by death all around them. And you start by describing the death of Tonka George, who was murdered on the street in 2016, just 7 weeks after he graduated from college.
This is somebody who did everything right. I mean, mm-hmm. It's easy in so many corners of America to say, you know, if somebody had just studied a little harder or tried a little harder or worked a little harder, it might have worked out for them. But gun violence and murder in New Orleans just aren't that simple. And somebody like Tonka, who had been a high school star, who had gotten a college scholarship, who graduated, had his degree, and was ready to enter the workforce, you know, he made one mistake, and that mistake was coming home to see his mom. You know, he loved his mom. They had only been separated once, and that was immediately after Hurricane Katrina. And he came home, wanted to get his bearings, and he hoped to move someplace else to start his life and their life together. But before he could do that, you know, he made a second mistake, and that was walking to a gas station to get a cigar. Mm-hmm. On his walk back, a car followed him. Nobody still knows why or who was in it, and they killed him. And it's a horribly tragic story, but it's all too common in places like Algiers and all throughout New Orleans.
And Bryce Brown keeps him alive, keeps his memory alive for himself and for the players as well.
Yeah, I sort of refer to Tonka as like a ghost that haunts the halls of a Makar. I mean, you really can't walk very far in the old building, which is where the story is set, without finding some reminder, intentional or not, of Tonka. You know, the auditorium is where they held Tonka's funeral. It was the first time they've ever had a funeral held there at the school. Bryce's office itself is crumbling and dilapidated, but it's sort of a time capsule of 2016, which is the year that Tonka was killed. Mm-hmm. There's a proclamation from the city. You know, there are news stories all from 2016. There's even a T-shirt with the word Tonka on it. So there's these constant reminders of what it takes to be remembered in a place like this. And is it really what you want? You know, I mean, it's a horrible thing. In Tonka's case, nobody's ever going to forget him, and it's all for the wrong reasons. The one thing that Tonka ever wanted was to be a beacon for the young people at Carr, to sort of show, you know, this is the path you could take. But he's become a beacon and somebody that you can't forget for all the wrong reasons.
Right. So talk a little bit about the coaching staff at Carr, because they are such memorable characters in this book, so generous and so forceful and so determined to make things better for their players. Tell us about them as men.
The first thing you notice about the coaches at Carr is just how honest they are.
Give them the real. I love that.
Give them the real. There's just sort of an inescapable part of my job as a sports journalist, and that's the coaches and players, you know, often want to give you sort of the sanitized version of themselves. And I assume this, they think this projects strength. But at Carr, it's not like that. I mean, when I first visited in August 2018, I had only been there for 20 or 30 minutes when a young player was telling me about the first time he broke into a house. My assistant coach was telling me about, you know, how he roughs up players sometimes and curses at them and insults them. And on the surface, this seems unnecessary. And why would you do that? And then you realize that these young people face much worse things. And honestly, being truthful with these people, in some cases brutally truthful with these people, is a great gift. You know, I mean, like, you're not staring at them and making this blanket statement of, you know, you're going to be dead or in prison by the time you're 18, because that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy amongst a lot of young people in this country. Being honest with them about what's expected, what they need to do, what their daily responsibilities are, you know, is really the best thing that these coaches can do for them. Yes, it's gruff. Yes, it's brutal. It is absolutely uncomfortable as somebody who lived it. It's not always an easy thing to experience or read, and it's certainly not something that's got to be easy to have somebody saying or yelling at you, but it works. Somehow, it works. And I think that this, you know, the way that they speak to and behave around these young people is the best possible way to do it.
Well, talk about Pride Panel, where they all get together.
Pride Panel is something of a leadership group. There are 14 players who sort of form this tribal council where they meet every day, and coaches less make the decisions about the direction of the team, the big picture decisions, than does Pride Panel. So this is where the team captains come from. These are thoughtful, smart young men with leadership capabilities. It's not just what you do on the field. It's how you sort of approach your day-to-day life. Are you reliable? Do you communicate clearly? Can you get yourself out of a jam? And so what Pride Panel does ultimately is it gives these young people a taste of accountability, which is something many of these folks have never encountered. But the coaches make them uncomfortable by design. And I write it as, this is almost, it's like a conditioning exercise. Just like a quarterback has to learn to recognize and beat the blitz, these young people have to learn how to identify a tense moment, you know, a difficult conversation that could turn ugly, it could turn violent, whether that's at a traffic stop, whether that's just walking down the street. They have to identify these threats just in day-to-day life or in communication and learn how to de-escalate them. So what the coaches do is they get in their face. You know, they force these confrontations. The players have to very harshly critique their teammates in front of everyone, and it's terribly uncomfortable. And, you know, these things often go until the wee hours of the morning. One of the nights we were up until almost 5 in the morning.
Wow.
Talking about what happened on the practice field the previous day. But what it does is it strips these players of any kind of pretense, you know, any kind of showmanship or anything like that, and just cuts them down to the psychological studs, you know, so that they can be rebuilt. And it's difficult, but somehow it's effective.
Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kent Babb, author of Across the River, Life, Death, and Football in an American City. Now, one of the problems these players face is that they're coming up against so many talented, well-coached, better-funded, and predominantly white teams. And you talk about that as a factor in playing the game. I think there's one game with John Curtis when it really comes up. Would you talk about that?
So there's an assistant coach at Carr who has a theory that he's tested over the course of 20 years on the staff there. He believes that Carr players in the typical game are fearless. You know, they're super well coached and smart and, yes, athletic, but they pay attention to the small details, the finer points of a very complex game, except when they play a predominantly white school. And there's a great deal, you know, of centuries-old psychology that possibly goes into this, but the belief is that New Orleans and indeed the United States is just not a place where white people lose, you know, not in getting home loans or in incarceration or in wealth, and certainly not on the football field. And so this is just a theory of his, and there's no way to definitively prove it, but Carr had not lost a game in 2 years when I started following them in 2019, and they played in their first four games. Bryce deliberately scheduled two predominantly white teams just to see how the team would respond, and they lost them both. And in fact, you know, one of those games was the worst loss of Bryce Brown's career as head coach. And you do start to see how this theory, you know, presents itself. You know, a lot of uncharacteristic mistakes on the field, turnovers, you know, just like there's sort of a lack of discipline on the field. There's a lack of hunger. They're just mistakes that this team doesn't often make. And it's disappointing. In fact, it's heartbreaking, because there's certainly no real evidence that suggests that this team can't go toe-to-toe with any team, maybe in the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the psychological roadblock that when they go up against a John Curtis or a Catholic High out of Baton Rouge or a Neville from Monroe, that they just can't hang. And it's heartbreaking for me as a white person to be an outsider and getting to know these people and believe that they believe that, to understand that they truly believe that. I've just never seen that before. I've never seen that perspective before, and it just completely opened my eyes.
Mm-hmm. You've written about the difficulty we have in our conversations about race. So what was the greatest difficulty you had as a white person writing this story?
Not so much difficulty, but, you know, maybe the thing that I'm most pleased about is just how welcoming the Carr program was to me. You mm-hmm. know, like, I personally embraced my whiteness, my outsiderness. You know, I just sort of made it a point to not go into this community and, you know, judge or draw easy conclusions or anything like that. I really wanted to listen, learn, observe, and just live. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. I did not move to New Orleans during this time. I flew back and forth 19 times
wow.
in 8 months. I've got a young daughter, so that was a little bit tricky from time to time. But I just needed to see and breathe in this environment that's completely foreign. You know, I'm not from Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from the South, but a very different South in South Carolina. But more than anything, these are people who will be honest with you and say, look, I don't trust white people, but I want you to come see this how it really is, and we're not going to sugarcoat it. We're not going to change our language. We're not going to change our behavior. We're not going to lie for you or anybody else. Is that okay with you? And the answer is a resounding yes, because that was the exact portrait that I wanted to paint, a real-life, unapologetic, this is how it is, and this is what it takes to make it out of a community like this. So the fact that these people, you know, they had no reason to trust me or to let me in, but for some reason they did, is something that I don't even know if proud is the right word, but it's something that has humbled me. And, you know, it's a great honor that I was able to sort of see behind this cultural curtain that so many times either people don't want to see or aren't willing to go commit themselves to seeing.
So what did this do for you as a writer? There's a lot of passion in this book. There's a lot of great storytelling, and you just have unbreakable narrative energy. I mean, I was just turning pages like there was no tomorrow. So did you have a sense you were doing something different or bigger or better than you had done before?
I mean, I called my wife and my literary agent and said, this is the best story I'll tell in my whole life. The only thing that could disrupt the story was me and, you know, my ability to tell it the right way. And because, like, these things just kept happening. The characters are so relentlessly real and honest and multidimensional, and you know, all I had to do was just get out of the way. You know, I mean, there's remarkably little me in this book, and that's on purpose, because it didn't need my analysis. It didn't need my perspective. I mean, there's some, you know, where I'm sort of psychoanalyzing Bryce and some of the things that other people in his life won't do for him that I think he needs. But for the most part, you know, I just wanted to be a photographer almost and just stand and absorb. But yeah, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. I'll never have better access, better characters. I'll never have the opportunity that I had throughout 2019 to tell this remarkable story that to these people, to the folks at Carr, they think this is just everyday life. You know, I constantly was telling them, you know, this is not the way it is most places.
Yeah.
And you know, they find that hard to believe. It's just day-to-day life for them. And for me, it's the best story I'll ever tell.
We've been talking with Washington Post sports writer Kent Babb, whose new book is Across the River, Life, Death, and Football in an American City. Like all great sports books, it's a compelling tale of courage and endurance. Kent, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you very much for having me.
New Orleans writer Samantha Downing made a big splash with her debut novel, My Lovely Wife, about a married couple who turned to serial killing to spice up their love life. That book was published in 2019. She followed that up with a thriller about a dysfunctional family road trip. He started it, published in 2020. Now she's back with the absolutely chilling For Your Own Good, set in the hothouse world of a private school. It will definitely make you turn those pages. Samantha Downing, welcome back.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Well, I have to hand it to you. You're the master of the high concept novel. Married serial killers, road trip gone wrong, and now murder in private school. And you write in your epilogue that you drew from some of your own experiences for this.
Yes, some of my own high school experiences with teachers and being a student. I didn't go to private school. I didn't get anything like Belmont Academy in the book, but it was high school nonetheless, and we all went through it.
Yes, we did. Now, creating Belmont Academy itself must have been so much fun. It has a kind of shadow of death quality going for it from the get-go, with a history of loss, lots of school memorial services.
Yes. I come from California, and those back east old world schools always had a certain mystique about them for me, because I didn't go to one, didn't know anybody that went to one, and I only saw them on TV and in movies, so it sort of had a ethereal quality to it, and so it was fun to try to create one, invent one of my own, and use my imagination of what I thought it would be like to go to a school like that.
And the power dynamics, there's a kind of I alone can fix it, or I'm the one who knows best, or I will save the legacy of this school. There's that mentality among teachers, administrators, parents, and even students.
Absolutely. I think in a private school like that, the power dynamics are really complicated, because you have teachers trying to teach the students, which is their job, but then you have parents that are paying bills and making the donations, so they technically are paying the teachers' salaries, and they want to tell the teachers how to do their job, and they have the teachers themselves, and they have their own power structure within their staff. So there's a whole lot of dynamics going on. On top of all that, you have kids that are driving better cars than the teachers are.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, we've all had one of those teachers like Teddy Crutcher. So what was it like to spend so much time with a conniver and a schemer making that character up?
Teddy's a lot of fun. He has his own belief system, and he believes he knows what's best for the kids, and that it's his job to teach them. It's not necessarily things that are on a standard lesson plan. And he grades them according to his own criteria, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with merit. But in his mind, it is all for their own good.
Well, that's true. And everybody's had the egomania of a powerful English teacher before them. Just asking them to choose between Moby Dick and Bleak House, Samantha, that was really sadistic, I think.
Yeah.
Now, these murders are mostly plant-based, if you'll, use that phrase. So I have to ask you, do you have a garden we should be aware of? How much research did you have to do for this?
I had to do a lot of research into it. I don't have a garden, and I don't have any interest in gardening at all. So all of this was research into the effects of different plants, how long it takes, exactly what it does to the body. I had to get really the right ones for my purposes and find the ones that would have the effect within a certain amount of time, because I've discovered that readers will Google things. So mm-hmm. if I name a real plant and I get the effects of it wrong, somebody's going to email me about that. You can only apparently be fictional about certain things, not everything. So.
Well, it all seemed very exact.
Yes.
Now, some of the themes that run through this book and spark these murders are the themes of competition and revenge, which are really natural to this setting, it seems to me.
Absolutely. This is a school where parents expect their kids to succeed, and where kids have very successful parents, which allows them to go to this kind of a private school, and as well as the teacher. Some of the teachers are wealthy, some of the teachers are not. They are just on a regular teacher salary. So there's competition among all the groups within the school.
Now, do you feel like with this book, this is your third book, do you feel like you've really hit upon what makes a Samantha Downing novel? You have these really great titles that are catchphrases. You have these incredible chapter endings that are great cliffhangers. And you have a kind of recognizable voice now. Did you feel a difference? Did you feel like you'd fallen upon your own voice?
Maybe. This one was a little bit different because it has multiple points of view. My first two books were written from a single point of view. So
right.
This one has more a bigger range of what the story is, because you see it through multiple guys, which was a lot of fun to do as well. So they're all Samantha Downing.
Of course they are.
In their own. They're dark, they're twisty, they're funny. There's a lot of dark humor in it. I don't know if I could write something that didn't have dark humor in it. And hopefully they're fun to read.
Oh, they're so much fun to read. I grabbed it up the day it came and started to read. So, now, since we talked last time, you've had some really exciting news about your work making it to the screen, haven't you?
Yes. For Your Own Good was optioned by Robert Downey Jr. and Greg Berlanti. He's the man who made The Flight Attendant on HBO and You on Netflix and lots of other TV shows. And they partnered together to make a limited series of this for HBO Max.
Yay!
And I'm very excited to see how that turns out.
And what about My Lovely Wife?
My Lovely Wife was optioned by Kidman's production company and was on Studios to be a feature film. And I'm excited to see that as well.
So, oh, I will be too.
With Hollywood, you never know what's actually going to get made and what's not, because there's so much time and money involved in each production that you never know what exactly is going to get greenlit. So I hope one of them does.
Oh, I do too. Whatever you're doing, it's absolutely working. So I have to ask, are you already into your fourth book now? Have you hit upon a rhythm to just keep turning them out?
Yeah, I'm writing my fourth book now. It was really difficult during the pandemic to get something going, or during the early days of the pandemic to get something going. But I am now writing my fourth book, so there'll be another.
Excellent. So what does it feel like to know that there are millions of people on beaches reading your book? That has to be very satisfying, because you pop up every summer with a perfect beach book.
It's great. I'm glad people are enjoying them, really. I mean, that's the goal of a writer. If a writer has one goal, it's people turn the page. So whatever gets people to do that, whatever their thing is, whatever their genre is, if I can make people turn the page and want to know what happens next and be invested in what happens next, I've done my job. So as long as I can keep doing that, then it's good.
We've been talking with Samantha Downing, whose third thrill ride of a novel is For Your Own Good. You can meet her Tuesday, August 31st at Barnes & Noble Metairie at 5:30. Or again, Thursday, September 9th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books on Oak Street. That is a ticketed event. Samantha, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. And just a reminder, with evolving COVID restrictions, best to check with venues before attending in-person events. And be sure to mask up. In New Orleans, Bob Mann discusses and signs Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics, Saturday, August 28th from noon to 2 at Barnes & Noble in Harvey. April Fields, author of A Version of You and Wildflower, presents a performance and reading followed by a book signing, Sunday, August 29th at 2 at Blue Cypress Books. Check out bluecypressbooks.com for ticket info. Samantha Downing signs For Your Own Good, Tuesday, August 31st at 5:30 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Maurice Carlos Ruffin discusses and signs The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, Tuesday, August 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.